The Tom Woods Show, episode 1222.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you agree with me that it is impossible to have a rational discussion about guns on social media these days, then you are going to love my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Guns. It's full of all the arguments you'll ever need. Check it out at wrongaboutguns.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. What a fascinating guest we have today. It's Rachel Fulton Brown. And she is Associate Professor of Medieval History at the University of Chicago, where she specializes in the history of Christianity, medieval European intellectual, cultural, and religious history, medieval liturgy, the cult of the Virgin Mary, and scriptural exegesis and hermeneutics. She is my new favorite person in the world in that I find her endlessly fascinating. She's extremely knowledgeable about a great many things, has interesting things to say about a wide variety of subjects, keeps me entertained no matter what the subject is, just fantastic. And she's gotten herself into some trouble recently, and I want to talk about that in academia because I'm always interested in professors who are put upon by crazy people. She does have a recent book, and we are going to talk about it a little bit, and that is Mary and the Art of Prayer, The Hours of the Virgin in Medieval Christian Life and Thought, from Columbia University Press, published just last year. She and I both got our PhDs at Columbia, as a matter of fact. Now, this book is on a subject that's not the typical subject for the Tom Woods Show. So I urge you to indulge us in a little discussion of that, no matter how much you're not interested in it, because you should enjoy the rest of the conversation at the very least. But you may also find this interesting too, because she has a way of making everything under the sun interesting. But this is going to be a freewheeling discussion about a lot of fun, interesting topics with a completely fearless academic. And there are so few of those. There are libertarians out there who pose as fearless, but they're fearless when it comes to, like, tariffs. They're against tariffs. Wow. Gee, that's bold. That's bold. Well, wait till you hear Rachel Fulton Brown. This is what we need in academia. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom.
All right, this is going to be a lot of fun. You and I have...
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say we have the same enemies, like exactly the same people, but it's the same group of losers who seem to dislike both of us.
We can make an enemies list. Shall we do that?
Yeah, I know, indeed. Well, look, I can say this. You and I are on somebody else's list, that's for sure.
Yep.
And as I was looking over the work you do, of course, you're a medievalist and you have a new book out I just told the folks about, I thought to myself, you know, the things I do are a little bit out of fashion in academia this year, but a medievalist focusing on Marian piety, I think, is even more out of the mainstream of what people are doing these days, frankly, in medieval studies.
Well, yes, I agree. I'm trying to drag it into the mainstream because I think devotion to Mary will save Western civilization.
So that's...
Would you like me to elaborate?
I would like to know how that... Especially because... Well, first of all, I can't even tell from your blog. I feel like you're a Catholic sympathizer who's not Catholic. Am I right?
No, I am a Catholic convert as of last year.
Oh, okay. Because I was looking at things from a few years ago.
Right. And I grew up Presbyterian.
What it was.
Right. And my journey as a Presbyterian has been very important because Presbyterians love Scripture and love commentary on Scripture and love thinking through Scripture. So most of my work as my scholarship has been about devotion to Mary as it's expressed through commentaries on the Song of Songs, on the Psalms, through the liturgy, through her offices. But when I finished my second book, I finished writing it and revising it a couple of years ago, and obviously it came out last year, then I knew it was time to finally make the step. And my very good friend, and I understand he's sometime your friend too, Milo, gave me that last nudge that I needed. So now I'm actually in the church.
Well, how about that? I would say that's probably one of the more unlikely paths right?
Which one, Milo or Scripture?
I'm going with Milo. That's not what people would naturally think. Now, let me just say right off the bat that obviously I mean, I want to get to the controversy and people who don't like you and stuff, because that's really juicy. But
I don't know why.
But you
don't know why they don't like me.
I don't know why they don't like me either. You know, I'm about the most amiable guy you could possibly ask for. And I'm perfectly willing to make concessions to people. If they just approach me without calling me a Nazi, if they could do me that courtesy, I am very conciliatory.
We're doomed. We're doomed.
Well, but here's what I want to ask you. Bear in mind that I have an audience that a lot of them have no religious affiliation. A lot of them are Protestants. And of those Protestants, a great many will view the idea of Marian devotion as just horrific. So you're going to have to tread carefully if you're going to make that kind of claim that you say you can make.
I can. And I say at the outset of my book that it's sort of curious to me that, as I say, Mary chose me to do this work. Because, of course, as I said, I grew up Presbyterian. I grew up without any understanding of the medieval devotion to Mary or any understanding of the scriptural basis for that devotion. And so I think it was an important path for me. And hopefully it can be a path that I can help others to see not just why Mary matters to Christianity, but how with the Reformation, Western culture lost a very rich tradition of scriptural interpretation, which I think is one of the reasons that Christianity has trouble right now sometimes capturing people's imagination. In my version of things, we sort of left out the fun bits by focusing in the way that Protestants typically have on the sort of basis of Christian understanding of the scriptures. I can certainly go into that in depth if you want me to.
Well, let's do that. And again, bear in mind, I really, given the subject matter of my program, we can sort of tarry on this only for so long, but still, it's good for people to have their horizons broadened. Your book, Mary and the Art of Prayer, at least the portion that I was able to read, goes into extraordinary depth about the history of Marian devotion, in particular, the Ave Maria, and the insistence that so many church leaders had on making sure that people knew it and were saying it, and what the significance of it is, what the significance of phrases in it are, like full of grace. What does that actually mean? It turns out that there isn't a wasted word in anything here. It's everything. It's like the Nicene Creed. There isn't a wasted word of the Nicene Creed. Everything serves a theological and pedagogical purpose.
And that's because, in fact, Mary is the mother of the Word. And I'd say that, you know, that opening understanding is that Mary gives birth to Christ, to God, and she is the mother of the Word. So, of course, a greeting that the angel brings to her that says, you are going to be the mother of the Word, is going to be pregnant in every syllable. And many of the meditations that I talk about in my book are showing the way in which human language is the way in which God is trying to communicate to us. And in order for God to be communicated through human language, absolutely there's a wonderful meditation that I end that second chapter that you read, from Serva Sanctus of Faenza, who's a Franciscan writing in the late 13th century in Florence. And he has this little exercise, this little grammatical exercise that he goes through saying, you know, how many letters are there in the Ave Maria? How many syllables are there? How many words? And showing how, and it's a numerological meditation, but it's also a meditation on the fullness of that greeting to say, this is the way we see that the creator of all came into his creation, that you have to understand not just the Psalms as the way in which God speaks through David and therefore, you know, speaks to the world through those meditations, but in fact, absolutely every creature in creation is singing the praises of Mary. And in that book, that chapter, this is the chapter 2, and it's online if people would like to read, I show the way in which that greeting of the angel is used in the Middle Ages to say, to name Mary fully, you in fact need to name every creature in creation, because she is the mother of the Creator and he came into the world through her. That if we want to understand what happened at the Incarnation, we have to understand what it means to, you mentioned the Creed, to say, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, came into the world through her.
Now, having said all this, I
got really fast into the theology, didn't
no,
we?
No, it's true. And you know what's interesting is that Martin Luther himself did apparently have rather a tender devotion to Mary, and it was hard for him to break with that. I don't believe it was something he relished, but he believed that in light of his theology, he had to make that break. But he still, for example, defended her perpetual virginity, you know, as I'm fairly certain did the early reformers all held a number of beliefs about her that, well, let's just say have been challenged by subsequent Protestants, but certainly not by those founders.
Well, it's interesting what happened with Luther's devotion to Mary, because as you say, he did have a great reverence for her. His primary sort of spiritual metaphor was as a mendicant and as a beggar. And there's a wonderful essay by one of my colleagues, Roy Hammerling, who is in fact Lutheran, but studies things like the Our Father and the prayers throughout the Middle Ages, talked about the way in which the reason that Luther describes her as particularly humble and particularly lowly is because that to him was the most important relationship to God. Right? He himself in his own devotion is trying to understand himself as mendicant, as beggar, as humbled before God. And so he emphasized that in his description of her. Now, subsequent Protestants take that and run with this idea that, well, she's just a housewife. She's not really the queen of heaven. What's lost, and I say the scriptural understanding of Mary is lost, what's particularly lost in Protestant understandings of Mary is her role as wisdom and as mother of wisdom. And the reason that the Protestants have difficulty with this is because of the way in which they understand the canon of scriptures, that they do not recognize as revealed or as properly part of the canon, the principal books that are used in the Marian liturgy throughout the Middle Ages. They have Proverbs and they have the Song of Songs. They don't read those in the same way medieval exegetes would, but specifically they lose the Book of Wisdom and the Book of Sirach or Ecclesiasticus. These two books are the primary scriptural sources for the descriptions of Mary as wisdom with God at the beginning of creation. And the reason that they lose them is very complicated, has to do with the Hebrew tradition and the Hebrew scriptures that they have access to in the 16th century, which are from the Masoretic tradition, which developed in the rabbinic tradition in competition with, of course, the Christian exegesis. It goes back to early Christianity. It goes back to the fact that Wisdom and Ecclesiasticus are both in the Septuagint. They both have great Alexandrian roots from the diaspora. And it's that tradition of wisdom that I argue in my new book, The Mary and the Art of Prayer, that is really taken up in Christianity as the explanation for why we have Christ at all. And the Lord needs his mother. The Lord needs his mother who anoints him, who recognizes him, who crowns him, as it says in the Song of Songs, and who is the frame for his entering into the world. And that's the big argument that I make in the book, that Mary is the mother of wisdom, is recognized in the Middle Ages as herself wisdom. She's the magistra who teaches the trivium. She's the mother of the three great language arts, grammar, rhetoric, and logic. I'm not joking when I say Mary is the core of Western civilization, because it's this tradition of wisdom, this tradition of learning, this tradition of philosophy that in, for example, the medieval universities, metaphorically but also spiritually, she gives birth to, because she gives birth to the word. And the struggles that we've been having in education, in recognizing the relationship between religion and science, in understanding the proper relationship between creativity and the life of the towns and therefore capitalism, it's all there in what Henry Adams described in his Mont Saint-Michel and Chartres as the power of the Virgin to give birth to civilization. And I hint at that a little bit in my new book, Mary and the Art of Prayer, saying really to understand what happened with Western civilization, we need to understand her role in it. But it grounds down in this appreciation of what it means to say Mary showed to the world the Creator whom it had not seen. That's Anselm's great prayer that he writes in the 11th century. And it's the mystery of the liturgy that I'm trying to convey through my book.
You and I would have to talk about liturgy at some point.
We will.
For sure. Yeah. privately, because I don't want to try the patience of listeners. But
well, I think I've already thrown so much. I mean, it's like talk about throwing the meat at people. We need to go back to a little bit of milk and get them there more gently.
Well, look, first of all, if you're in Chicago, which I understand is where you are.
Yes.
Then you got to go to St. John Cantius.
Yes,
I mean,
I do.
You got to go to the old Latin. I mean, forget it. This whole liturgical reform was a complete fiasco and a disaster that has no arguments in its favor. I will hear none. Oh, but we needed to make the Mass more accessible. Yeah, then they would have just translated the Latin into English. They didn't do that. They did all kinds of stuff to water down. It's a fiasco created by, we now know, reprehensible human beings. So I'm just... Every day in my life, I'm vindicated in every belief I hold. But let me.
Well, that's good. And I'll say, so for random laypersons who are many of my friends on Facebook and I think now many of your listeners, those who the laity who actually wishes that the clergy would give us some more substance again, the core of the book, that my Marian Narrative Prayer, is the Book of Hours, which was the laity's liturgical practice in the later Middle Ages, and was, you know, in Latin. It was also translated into vernacular in Dutch. There are Middle English translations as well. But the core of the response to God, the response of wanting to stand before the throne of God and sing the Psalms, was there for the laity in the later Middle Ages. And that's another of the problems that the Protestant Reform brings, that the Book of Common Prayer that Cromwell writes obviously eradicates all of that understanding. So whatever happened with Vatican II was already obviously affected in the 16th century in English.
We have to have coffee at some point. There's so much talk about with this stuff. I want to say just a couple quick things before we move on. In the patristic period, I mean, really, really early, actually, there was this fondness for referring to Mary as the second Eve. And the idea here is that she's the Eve who gets things right. Rather than being disobedient, she's the one who consents to do the will of God. And so that is why we hold her in particularly high regard, because she is going to do God's will, and she's going to undo what Eve had done. That's the significance of this. The other thing I want to say is you're talking about Mary as and wisdom, and that just reminds me of the whole general caricature of the Middle Ages in general, which must be the bane of a medievalist's existence. I don't know how much time you have to spend explaining to people the reality of the situation. And then at the end of the day, no one's learned anything. The kids on the exam are still repeating it was dumb and backward and barbaric. You spent the whole semester telling them that this is Enlightenment nonsense that nobody should believe. So I want to ask you a little bit about that. I noticed that you refer favorably to Charles Homer Haskins, and his work on the Renaissance of the 12th century helped me in my popular book, How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization. But at the same time, you have an essay where you kind of acknowledge that there are two sides to the Middle Ages. Yes, it's true. There were parts of the Middle Ages that were barbaric, and there were parts that were more advanced, enlightened, and sophisticated than people think. So in that way, the Middle Ages are more like us than we're willing to acknowledge. It's not that, oh, thank goodness we've left that barbarism behind. We have our own. How dare you in 2018 lecture the world about the barbarism of the past? You have plenty of barbarism right here and now to be apologizing for. So yes, even today we have a mixture of enlightenment and sophistication with barbarism. That doesn't make us unlike the Middle Ages. It makes us like it.
I think you're referring to my post on my Fencing Bear blog, Make the Middle Ages Dark Again.
Oh, actually it was Defending the Middle Ages, We've Been Doing It Wrong.
Oh, yes. Okay, that one. There are many posts. The Make the Middle Ages Dark Again was a satire that I did last summer when everybody was in my academic field claiming that people who would argue for things like white ethnostates and such were drawing on medieval imagery to support themselves. And I was making the joke of saying, oh, well, we should, you know, if only people actually still believed that the Middle Ages were the Dark Ages, nobody would care about wanting to promote them. It was a joke, and it seems my colleagues in academia didn't get it. But
your colleagues in academia are humorless? I refuse to believe that.
Yes. And the thing is, in that post, I quote from Haskins' Renaissance of the 12th Century, saying, look, you know, for nearly 100 years, we've been trying to convince people that, you know, the Middle Ages were in fact a period of great intellectual growth and great sophistication and wisdom. Oh, you know, exactly why would anybody try to believe us when nobody's listened to us before? And that being my point, that indeed it seems ironic that right now I have colleagues in the field worrying about people appropriating the Middle Ages when what you've just said is in fact the case. So we're still fighting the Enlightenment in its description in the Middle Ages is dark. And, you know, Gibbon has won, right, as far as most people are concerned, saying that, you know, Christianity was responsible for the fall of civilization. And in fact, you know, the best hope that we have is the enlightened situation of his own day. I forgot what your question was there. What should I do?
I was just
caricatures the Middle Ages are as hard to, Enlightenment caricature of the Middle Ages is as hard to fight as, you know, sort of an elevated understanding of in fact, the longer argument that I make in defending the Middle Ages, that indeed it's out of the long European past, out of the period that we call the Dark Ages of the Middle Ages, that many of our great institutional structures have developed. The universities, the towns, indeed capitalism. Weber was wrong. It goes back before the Protestants. You know, the kinds of creativity and art and all of the wisdom and learning that we're trying to capture as whatever comes from the West, it has deep roots in the Middle Ages and is not really a product of antiquity so much as a product of the 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th centuries. So it's interesting that Europe has done this to itself, right? It's Europe's own self-critique. And Milo used that as a sort of tag for the recent article that he did about my controversies with my colleagues, that the Middle Ages is the source of much of the controversies that we're still arguing, precisely because Europe has always been, from the Middle Ages, engaged in this exercise of self-criticism.
Rachel, let me take just a minute to thank our friends at Skillshare, which is a longtime sponsor of the show. What they're doing is absolutely miraculous. I get that the economy these days is a little bit more complicated than it was when I graduated in 1994. You could have a degree in sociology and then go on to get a normal job somewhere, and those days seem to be over. But on the other hand, Skillshare has over 22,000 classes in all different areas, from design to writing to music editing to almost anything you can imagine. One subscription gets you all 22,000 classes. People would have killed for that. In fact, when one of my own children said that she was interested in animation, my first thought was, let's go over to Skillshare. That's exactly what we did, because they've got something for everything. Well, you can join the millions of students already on Skillshare today with a special offer just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That's right. Skillshare is offering Tom Wood Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 22,000 classes for just 99 cents. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/woods. Again, go to Skillshare.com/woods to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/woods. The issue of the church and science, I don't want to get into here, but that's where everybody thinks, well, we've got you dead to rights because I read 3 pages about Galileo,
right?
So I'm an expert on this. And it turns out that the real story of the church and science is so much more interesting. And today, when you go, there was a company, they used to be called the Teaching Company. Now they're called the Great Courses. And they go on site and they record courses by top professors and they sell them. But they sell them to a general audience, so they're not going to be pitching some weird interpretation. It's going to be, you're going to get a pulse on what the mainstream of that discipline is teaching when you take a course with them. So out of curiosity, about 10 years ago, I bought their course on the history of science, and I wanted to know, are they still teaching that it was all stupidity and backwardness, and then there was Isaac Newton, or has it gotten a little bit more sophisticated than that? And the professor, I don't remember his name, absolutely overturned that and said, no, it's silly to think that. And then he went through and, you know, he's talking about Albert the Great and all these other figures.
Mm-hmm.
So so now finally, at least among the in the profession of the history of science, they're starting to get it. The general public hasn't got a clue, but they're starting to get it. There's a huge amount of scholarship on this. So I wrote How the Catholic Church Built Western Civilization. The longest chapter is the one on science, because that's where you have the longest road to hoe. And Owen Benjamin, do you know the comedian Owen Benjamin?
I do, yes. Okay. He's on Stephen Crowder's show.
Okay, yeah. Well, Owen's been on with me. I'm sort of more small potatoes than Stephen Crowder, but I do my best. But Owen, apparently on his show some time ago, was really going after the church when it came to science. And then I ran into him a couple of months ago, and he said, you know what, Tom? I read what you wrote about the church and science, and you changed my mind. You changed my mind on this. That's what I'm here for. All right. I guess there are two things I want to do in the limited time we have left. The first thing is, well, you know what? Let's chuck the first thing. The second thing is, I want to know how somebody like you, who writes these scholarly studies, how it is that you would get in a position where I think it was the National Association of Scholars felt the need to intervene on your behalf. What on earth is going on with you?
Oh, my goodness. How much time do we have? So 3 years ago, I wrote a short little blog post called Three Cheers for White Men, in which I was trying to point out that women in Western civilization have a great deal to be thankful for. My three cheers being chivalry, consensual marriage, and the right to vote, with the rider of, and if you want to argue with me about these being goods, there's always freedom of speech, which is also a Western value. Thanks to that blog post, I came to the attention of a number of colleagues in my own field, medieval studies, who took this as proof that I'm a white supremacist and a neo-Nazi.
Yeah, what else would it be proof of, right? That's what a reasonable person would conclude.
Because I, you know, make cheers saying, in fact, you know, the ideal in Western civilization is that men do not rape women and that other men take men to task for doing that. That marriage is constituted not by a woman's family telling her who she has to marry, but by sacramentally, particularly by saying I do on the part of both parties. And that obviously politically women have been granted the franchise. And since the people who had the franchise before that were men, I wouldn't be able to vote if my, you know, great grandfathers hadn't voted for it. So had been called names for some time, but then I befriended Milo Yiannopoulos and it's just gotten more exciting ever since.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, how are you in a position where, am I remembering this right? That the NAS is basically appealing to your colleagues to come to your aid?
They are. That's thanks to the long article that Milo published about 2 weeks ago called Middle Rages, where he details, in fact, how this 2-3 year controversy has developed around me. I mentioned the How to Make the Middle Ages Dark Again post. I wrote that last summer because many of my colleagues in medieval studies were concerned. It's such a long story. It took Milo 16,000 words. Concerned most immediately with what happened at Charlottesville, and we're calling on all of those of us who work in the field, and particularly medieval history, to stand up in front of our classes and say, you know, I'm not a white supremacist. So I did a post in answer to the colleague who wrote that post. This is also social media and blog, right? It's like Luther in the new print world, right? You suddenly have all this stuff flying at people so fast that they don't know how to process it. Anyway, I wrote a post September last year called How to Signal You Are Not a White Supremacist, in which I addressed my colleague in the field, Dorothy Kim, who had written this post saying, if you're white, you need to, basically she said that, if you're white, you need to stand up in your classroom and say you're not a white supremacist. And I said, oh, how shall I do that? I studied devotion to the Virgin Mary, and one of the most important antiphones, it's a liturgical text, a chant, used in the Marian liturgy throughout the Middle Ages is Nigra sum sed formosa, I am black but beautiful, comes from the Song of Songs. It's the occasion of a number of commentaries on what it means for Mary to be dark, and sometimes proofs that she is in fact dark of eyes, dark of hair. Therefore, I'm not much a white supremacist if that's who I'm studying. More soberly, I suggested that my colleagues who are so anxious about this should do a little history. I used a colorful word in that. Colorful words always get the internet's attention. This produced an open letter suggesting that I had called for violence against my colleague for arguing with her. Because I was friends with Milo, it spiraled into, and basically she's called for Professor Kim to be violently attacked, of course, over the last year, the only person who has been, you know, called for violent attack against is me. And this is embedded in a bigger argument that the field is having. And Milo tried to lay all that out in his Middle Rages piece, that you can find that on dangerous.com. When Milo wrote it up in full and talked to some of my senior colleagues who said, yes, this has been happening. It's unfortunate that Rachel's been caught in the middle of this. It's strange that no one else has like stood up for her to say she has said nothing except to defend Christianity and Western civilization from allegations being made in the field. The National Association of Scholars put up this open letter saying, why has not at least her employer issued some kind of statement to say, look, she hasn't called for violence. She hasn't been harassing anybody. All she's been doing is disagreeing on the issues. And exactly why is that so hard to say in the current academic climate?
Yeah, that's rather an ordeal. See, there are two ways I want to go, and I think I need to just have you do another episode with me at some point, because I would like to know, but maybe I won't do that this time. I would like to know how the medieval studies have been affected by the crazies, because medieval studies, I thought for a while, was one of these areas where it was mostly normal people, because if you really, really hated European civilization, this is the last thing you would devote your life to. You would not study the Middle Ages. And then secondly, by studying it, you realize, hey, this is not the caricature I thought. You begin to love it, and it normalizes you. And I'm wondering, okay, maybe yes, I am drifting into this. I'm wondering, what have they done to it?
Well, exactly what you just described, right? That for a long time, the people who wanted to study the Middle Ages were a little out of the mainstream. That when you and I were in graduate school, we were both at Columbia, you'll remember that. I mean, for the medievalists, we tended to be the ones that the Americanists and the modern Europeanists looked at and said, like, who are you and why are you studying that? That's so irrelevant. That I think, you know, that medieval studies held out for a very long time because the people attracted to the period tended not to be engaged in the same kind of modernist questions as people who are interested in bringing those questions into medieval studies. You know, it gets attention. It's certainly one of the things that works in the academy if you want to make a stir to claim. I mean, gender studies has been a feature of the field since I was in graduate school. And of course, one of the reasons that I am under fire in quite the way that I am has nothing to do with being friends with Milo and everything to do with the fact that I studied the devotion to the Virgin in the way that I do, which is that I refuse to use gender theory as my lens through which to talk about devotion to Mary. I go back and I read the primary sources, as a good medievalist should. And I am trying to show that the way in which medieval Christians talked about Mary is richer. If you want to talk about it as gender fluid, there's ways to think about it in those terms, because of course the commentaries on the Song of Songs that I started my research with are very gender fluid in their appreciation of the complexities of talking about the relationship between the human and the divine as expressed through the bride and the bridegroom of the Song of Songs. But I've always resisted reducing this wonderful imaginative world to the categories of modern gender theory, because of course the categories of modern gender theory basically say Mary was raped and that's that, and God's a patriarchal tyrant. That is, of course, not what I see in the devotion to Mary in the Middle Ages, and it's what I've tried to show again in my two books, From Judgment to Passion and Mary and the Art of Prayer. How race studies comes into medieval studies, there has been over the last 20, 30 years, and it's contemporary with my own work, an effort to show the way in which Christianity was throughout the Middle Ages in conversation with Judaism and Islam. This in the Middle Ages is not racial in the way those relationships are now characterized. It's theological. And again, I get into trouble here because I say, you know, Christianity and Judaism have a long and complicated conversation. If you want to understand that, it means that you have to take scriptural exegesis seriously. It means you have to take the claims of Christians that Jesus is Lord seriously. Obviously, that comes up against Islam because Islam does not recognize Jesus as the Son of God, quite the reverse. They consider it blasphemous to claim that God has any associates, as they say, and blasphemous to claim that Mary gave birth to God. Those are the terms in which it's talked about in the Middle Ages, but these are not terms that modern scholars are typically well-versed in because most modern scholars know nothing of theology. I did a little post. If you want to know yet again why I'm in trouble with my colleagues, it's so many layers. One of the reasons was that I was asked back in February 2017 when Milo's talk at Berkeley was disrupted to do a little piece for the Martin Marty Center newsletter sightings about what I saw Milo's campus tours illustrating about religion on college campuses. And the argument I made was we're in a religious crisis, that when people talk about race and gender, now they're doing it basically with as religious propositions, right? It's basically blasphemy to argue against the way in which gender theory or race theory has presented the issues. I say this is explosive, and that's why there's such an explosion around Milo's talks, because we are inexperienced in arguing theology. We're inexperienced in arguing these basic premises. If we want to not have violence spilling out from our college campuses onto the streets, as it did in Berkeley in February 2017, we as academics need to take this seriously as a religious crisis. For that, I was condemned by 29 of my colleagues in the Divinity School at the University of Chicago. They put up a little letter.
Oh, of course. The Divinity School is always hopeless.
They put up a little letter saying, I do not represent the diversity that they do. That was the original source of many of the insults that Milo chronicles in Middle Rages, you know, people talking about my looks, saying that, you know, I supported white supremacy, because I said, we're in a religious crisis, we're in a theological crisis, and what we have at stake here are two religious systems that are at odds with each other, and we need to be able to appreciate that and see the stakes in those terms. I tell you, you do not get to ask a simple question and not have this like turn into a problem about everything.
No, I totally understand. I don't know what it would be like to be in academia these days. I left it a long time ago, and
this is what it's like.
Yeah, I just sit behind a microphone and observe at a distance at this point, and I cheer on and support people who are doing their best to fight back. Have you had any contact, by the way, with Jordan Peterson?
Well, that's a long story. In spring 2017, I emailed him in the midst of the kinds of things that were being said about me, because, of course, he said some very wise things, very perceptive about Milo, although I, you know, will admit the fact that I was there first. It's in my blog. He was asked about what he thought about Milo at the end of that week in February 2017. He said Milo was a trickster. I'd been writing about Milo on my blog, Fencing Bear, as a kind of holy fool. I compared him to Jesus as a kind of holy fool. And of course, at that point, I was writing about, you know, what was happening to Milo is basically his shaming and crucifixion. In terms of his career, yes, it was. And I wrote to Jordan at that point and was very interested in the mythological level that he had been able to tap into. I did a little interview with Jordan's friend, Jonathan Pageau, that's on Jonathan's YouTube channel, when we talked through both my conversations with Milo and the way in which I saw what Jordan was doing was very much in sympathy with at least my desire to show people how what's been going on is happening at this very deep mythological symbolic level. Jordan's star has risen since then, and I do have quarrels with him on a theological level. I've blogged a bit about that, but we haven't yet had that conversation. I'm not sure at this point whether that's the best conversation to have for either of us, so we'll just see where that goes.
All right. Well, I'm actually coming up I think probably what I should have done with you is had a Joe Rogan-style three-hour conversation. Of course, I can't trespass on your time quite that much, but if I could maybe stretch it out across another conversation, because there's so many things to talk to you about. You have opinions on so many things. You're just like me. You have opinions on everything, and you've written about everything, and it's all out there in the open, and people, what's beautiful about having things out there in the open is that people of goodwill can just go back and see what you said.
Right.
So that, you know, when the crazies come after you, you can say, all right, look, I'm not going to persuade the crazies or their supporters, but I can appeal to normal people and I can say words have meanings, and all you have to do is look at the words that I wrote and you'll see there's nothing wrong with any of it. I mean, maybe it's a little controversial, but it's controversial only because everyone else is crazy. It's not really that controversial.
Well, as I said, you know, I've been startled. And, you know, in retrospect, okay, maybe not that surprised, but I was startled at first with the response to my Three Cheers post. And I did a set of responses then back in January 2016, answering particularly the question of what I meant by chivalry, because that's a complicated tradition. It's a complicated argument. It's not so simple to say as, you know, men don't. I do not think in Western civilization we value rape in any way. I think that's an utter misrepresentation of everything. But obviously, not all men have lived up to those ideals. Not all women have lived up to the ideal that chivalry would place on them to be, you know, ladies. I think I probably need to do some posts on that. And I honestly at that point thought, if I just explain all of this, maybe I won't convince Professor Kim, but surely I'll convince my other colleagues in academia. That has not happened. And, you know, it's continued. I also thought it would, you know, I'd start writing about Milo if I could just explain clearly what I saw and how, in fact, he's none of the things that, of course, the mainstream media has labeled him as. I will chronicle this in full, and my Milo chronicles on the blog are quite extensive. People will read it and they will be persuaded, and anything that Joe Bernstein says on BuzzFeed will be shown to be utter misrepresentation. That hasn't happened. And I, you know, culturally and in the cultural moment, I find that fascinating. Why is it that when I've written it at great length about all of these issues, it doesn't persuade even some of my colleagues who've known me since graduate school?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a weird, and you know, what's funny is that here we are in 2018, 2015 almost seems like a paradise compared to today. I mean, it's happening so fast that things that people feel like they can't say, or if somebody else says, then they have to shun you completely. Or yes, if you find out that somebody who runs a sandwich shop may be supporting some candidate you don't like, then you can't eat a sandwich from that place. And I mean, what a dreary life to have your whole life dominated by politics and theories of domination. What a miserable, horrible existence that must be.
Well, and I say that that's because we've lost our faith. The faith that I see as what one of the courses I teach for our undergraduates is on Tolkien, and that the faith that I see that I'm trying to help communicate through my scholarship is also the faith that Tolkien was dedicated to trying to illustrate. And it's a faith in art and creativity and joy. And I mean, obviously the ability to stand up against the temptation to dominate others' wills. That's the point of the ring, right? That the ring gives you the power to dominate others' wills. And for Tolkien, you know, the great mystery is, you know, our ability to make choices, the mystery of free will. And when I teach the Lord of the Rings, that's, you know, one of the major themes in the course is how Tolkien is showing us the importance of being able to make choices and the difficulty of making them well. And that we are also called on as creatures made in the image and likeness of God to create beauty and to exercise our, you know, the role as sub-creators. That's his term. But that we're also always being tempted to try to hold on to our creations. And that's the great sort of tragedy of the Silmarillion. All of these truths about our existence as creatures, our abilities as human beings, our temptations as creatures with free will. I say one of the great, probably the reason we're in this great political crisis is, of course, people don't have that grounding, right? We don't have that grounding in what we call the Judeo-Christian tradition, but it's really a grounding in the understanding of these complexities of what it means to be human in relationship to a divine that has given us these great gifts of both creativity and choice. So yes, people have no anchor to be able to navigate this freedom and what that actually entails.
Yeah. Yeah. And the anchor is just the one thing in the world they won't touch with a 10-foot pole. Every passing fad, they cannot jump on fast enough. Right, every passing fad in society that maybe we will laugh at 10 years from now, that they're all ready for, but anything more significant than that. I want to make sure and link to stuff you're doing. So certainly we're going to link to Mary and the Art of Prayer, the Hours of the Virgin in Medieval Life and Thought. So we'll definitely encourage people to check out your most recent book. I'll have that linked at tomwoods.com/1222, which is the episode number. But I also am going to make sure and link to your blog. In fact, I've got right here. Yeah, it's a Blogspot blog. So it's fencingbearatprayer.blogspot.com. And so if you're on the road and you can't get that all down, I'm going to link to it at tomwoods.com/1222. But I think it's pretty obvious that Rachel Fulton Brown is somebody you're going to want to get to know. And I hope I will have a further opportunity to get to know. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for talking.
All right, folks. Wow. What a conversation. All right. Let me tell you what's coming up, because we got a couple interesting things. One of them I haven't mentioned yet. Let's see. Tomorrow it's Ben Settle and Shane Hunter, and we're going to talk about how to profit off your enemy's tears. We are hardcore, okay? We are badass on this show when we have to be. Then after that, we've got Cody Wilson coming back to talk about, obviously, you know, what he's up to, which is great. He's a fascinating guy. I love talking to him. And then also, and I didn't mention this the other day, but wrapping up the week, I'm going to have two economists on. We're going to evaluate Elizabeth Warren's plan to save capitalism. And it turns out that this plan to save capitalism is not really a plan to save capitalism. Now, maybe I did mention that. I can't remember if I mentioned that or not. Maybe I did mention that. Well, even if I did, it's not a bad thing to remind you how great these episodes are. So make sure you have subscribed to the show, which you can do very easily for free over at tomwoods.com/iTunes. See you later.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.